Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141, WHUT TV, YouTube, and 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our conversation about in-custody deaths. My guests are Dr. Roger Mitchell, Chair of Pathology at the Howard University College of Medicine and author of the book Death in Custody, How America Ignores the Truth and What We Can Do About It, as well as Professor Justin Hansford, Executive Director of the Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. You can also chime in online using the hashtag #InCustodyDeaths. Okay, so let's talk a little bit, Dr. Mitchell, about your book. You wrote this book again, Death in Custody, How America Ignores the Truth and What We Can Do About It. You say the U.S., you touched on this earlier, you say the U.S. significantly undercounts the number of people who die in law enforcement custody every year. Why do you say there is an undercounting?
Well, right now, the Bureau of Justice Administration and the Bureau of Justice Statistics at the Department of Justice have been required to count how many people are dying in custody based upon the definition that we laid out earlier. And they're currently not doing it. So when I say that they're undercounting, they're not counting as of now. They were counting from 2000 to 2019. And Senator Ossoff out of Georgia just had a hearing a couple months ago. I believe it was in April of 2023. And he showed through his analysis that even what was being counted, there were 990 cases that were missed based upon the Department of Justice counting. So we know that there's an undercounting, and we know that there's an improper counting from the federal and local levels. What we're suggesting is the Department of Justice should not be the only ones counting these deaths. The Centers for Disease Control should be counting these deaths by putting a checkbox on the U.S. Standard Death Certificate and that checkbox saying death in custody, yes or no. And those individuals like me that certify death for a living be required to report those deaths in custody, not just law enforcement.
Professor Hansford, why do you believe this is still happening after the death of George Floyd? Obviously, when you have video, black folks have been saying, I told you so about this for forever. Mm-hmm. As I said, Rodney King, I told you so. George Floyd, I told you so. Just yesterday, on this program, we had attorney Malik Zulu Shabazz. He is representing the two black men in Rankin County, Mississippi, who were assaulted, brutally assaulted, sexually assaulted. One of them shot. Both of them lived. And for those who aren't familiar with it, five former sheriff's deputies pleaded guilty in federal court last week, and a former police officer also pleaded guilty to this torture, sexual assault, and the like. Why is this happening?
Racism. And we're talking about
structural
issues.
I can just stop the program right there. Racism.
Right, just stop it right there.
Good
right?
night, everybody.
Well, you know, we're talking about structural issues.
Yeah.
And what took place after the killing of George Floyd, and to a large extent, Mike Brown and Trayvon Martin and Eric Garner and Sandra Bland, is that the conversations were focused on individual officers, bad apples, and the actual change that we needed to see on a structural level were blocked. And we saw that in the past 3 years, for example, people have shifted to think about education and thinking about DEI. There are a number of other ways that we try to push our energy from the George Floyd moment to make change. But you have to, it's a good time for us to reflect what actually has changed when it comes to law enforcement. And it's like a third rail in American politics where we haven't been able to get change. And one thing I wanted to say about death in custody for many years. The Washington Post, The Guardian tried to fill this gap in terms of counting how many people were killed by police. But that there was never a time in American history that local police departments were on board with counting how many people they killed. And think about that for a second. We're not even talking about how many people they injure or how many people they beat or how many people they shot who survived. Those numbers are much higher, obviously. We're just talking about how many people they killed. And for the richest country in the world to allow there to not even be a count of the violence that has taken place is just, it's mind-boggling when you think about it. And you really have to wonder what it's going to take for us to get to a place where that type of accounting takes place in America.
Okay, racism, I get it. Tyre Nichols was black, and the officers who are charged with his murder in Memphis, they're all black.
That's right.
Where's the racism?
Again, and the police chief was black.
Exactly.
When you say racism, again, people think about the individual officer, the individual police officials as the bad apples who must be involved in racism. But racism is not about what individual people do. Racism is about structures. So it's about the reason why you could see what happened in Memphis take place with an all-black police department is because the non-accountability that is baked into the Memphis Police Department was set up during a time when all the police were white and they were engaged in Jim Crow levels of violence. And so that culture was set then, and police officers who have to come into the department and choose whether they're going to be black or blue are brought into the culture, which is a racist culture. So in the same way that you can have racism in majority black police departments, you can have racism in majority black schools, you can have racism in majority black institutions around the country. We thought that that changing demographics could change structures and change cultures. But you can have black faces in high places have not solved our problem over the course of the 20th century and early part of the 21st century.
I need you to break that down just a little bit more. Paul from D.C., we're going to get to you in a bit. I haven't forgotten about you, but I need you to, to break this down for the people in the back of the room.
All right.
Because I'm trying to get into the heads of these officers who are accused, like you said, black officers wearing blue, killing another black man. And so you're saying that the structure of this particular police department was set up for them not to see his blackness?
No, for them not to be held accountable.
Well, but they're being held accountable.
Yeah, they are now because it became a national issue. But the reason that they did it in the first place is because they had a feeling, which was based on solid evidence, that they would not be held accountable. So if you look deep into that story, the reason for the aggression might have been some sort of personal relationship, and there are all these different factors. But the reason a black police officer feels that they could
get away with it
goes back to the structure of being above the law, the shield protecting you, and that structure was created from a time of racism where the police departments were an arm of racial violence in many ways, in many places in the world, in the country, still are, right? So those structures protect. I mean, so even if you take a step back, right? Why do you need a person with a gun to engage in a traffic stop? Why do you need a person with a gun in schools to tell a 5-year-old to stop acting out? Why do we have such a system of policing where violence is used in all of these different situations? Because the structure of this policing surveillance culture is a racial structure where you're trying to control black people. Now, if you insert a black face in that high place with that badge, they still have access to the same lack of accountability, the same power. At least in their minds, they feel they have access to the same power that existed in the past. So taking away that power from the police is what will ultimately allow us to have fewer deaths in custody, whether it's before the arrest, during the arrest, behind bars, when you're talking about correctional officers. But that's the third rail is taking away the power from the police.
Or taking away the belief that they won't be held accountable.
And that's part of why we can't have law enforcement counting the deaths that occur in their own care. That's why the public health surveillance of death in custody is so critically important. So imagine if we know how many people are dying by jurisdiction, in particular communities, by jails, by law enforcement, counties, cities. And that is just as available as the number of cases of cancer in this country, mm-hmm. just as available to us as the maternal mortality. There's a big push on how Black women are dying in and around pregnancy. Well, the reason why we know that is because there's a checkbox on the U.S. standard death certificate. Mm-hmm. The reason why we know people are dying from motor vehicle collisions and have these, you know, Vision Zero initiatives is because it's a checkbox on the U.S. standard death certificate. We can pull that power from law enforcement in understanding the disease and injury that's causing death, and also the disease and injury that may not be causing death, by being able to capture that on the death certificate. And we can no longer just allow law enforcement to be accountable to itself when there's the most sophisticated vital statistics system in the world that exists in the United States, but yet they're not counting the deaths that are occurring secondary to law enforcement. And that's why it's a public health issue, is that public health brings together the toolkit of not just medicine and healthcare, but the criminal legal system and community and law enforcement. It brings a bag of opportunity, a bag of tools to be able to understand a problem and then solve for that problem. And right now, how do you solve for a problem that you can only feel happens? You only feel like there's more people that are dying like George Floyd. You only feel like there's people that are dying like LaShawn Thompson, who died on a Fulton County jail floor. But until we can actually capture the data, we're not going to be able to really understand the scope of the problem.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Paul, calling from D.C. Thanks for hanging on. Paul, what's on your mind?
Hey, thank you so much for receiving me. I'm the agency commissioner for ABO2, and most of what this young gentleman just said, I agree with. However, we need to deal with the issues that are problematic within Washington, D.C., and I feel as though the mayor is not addressing the issue appropriately. We have too many homicides. You just had the council member come online this past weekend to discuss that we're in a state of emergency. I've said it from 2015 all the way up to now. We need to address the issue. How do we get these guns off our street?
Paul, hold on. Because I agree with you, but that's not what we're talking about tonight. We are talking about in custody death.
Okay.
So that and I'm not saying in any way, shape, or form that your point is not valid, but that's not the focus of tonight's conversation.
Okay, so when we talk about in custody death.
Yes.
Okay. I work for the hospital. I work for United Medical, okay?
Okay.
And I have officers that come over to our hospital when they have inmates that come there for medical reasons. Okay. We have an issue with this, what's going on over at DC jail. Okay, the structure, the management, we have an issue. But they've been having issues for years, okay? And the mayor, she called herself trying to correct this issue over there.
So, Paul, let me stop you one more time.
Okay.
Because I don't... We are talking about in custody death, whether those deaths come the moment that a law enforcement officer encounters a citizen and that encounter ends in the death of that citizen. Now, that also in custody death also includes when a citizen or a person is arrested and may be detained, whether they are detained at the police house or whether they are detained at a city or county jail. Now, if you have a comment about how we can address that particular issue, I am most certainly... So go right ahead. Let's talk about that.
Like I said, I work for United Medical Hospital.
Okay.
And I've had officers that come over there because they have medical problems with inmates that come from the jail that just there. Okay? And what I have been informed is that, you know, you don't know. They got shanks and stuff like that. They put people in there in these jail cells.
Mm-hmm.
And that they, you know, shanks. I won't divulge the person's name, the officer's name, but they told me. They said, Paul, we
so you're so what you're saying is that these things happen when police officers are possibly defending themselves?
They're defending themselves. Not only that, but they see stuff that's going on in that jail.
So, Paul, I'm gonna have to stop you because I think you've missed the point. But I thank you for at least attempting to participate in this conversation. My point, and I think that, you know, Dr. Mitchell, yes, we understand that things happen in detention, okay? But I would argue anecdotally that really isn't, you know, that really isn't the issue. If you, you know, look, if you are searched and you are, and they take any potential weapons, anything that may be used as a weapon, and you are handcuffed, and now you are being, you know, questioned or what have you, nothing should happen to you. You should not, you shouldn't die, you know, when you are in the custody, you know, of police officers, if you are, not resisting that. That should not happen. Whether it happens during a traffic stop, you know, there was that young man that in Prince George's County a couple of years ago who was body slammed, mm-hmm. and ended up with being a quadriplegic, and he eventually did pass away, and the officer was held, you know, accountable. But none of that should be happening.
No, and you know, in again, chapter 7 of our book, we go deep into the Sandra Bland story,
mm-hmm.
and how from the beginning of her interaction with law enforcement, there was opportunities for the law enforcement to de-escalate or not escalate, not even de-escalate, because she never escalated, right? And she found herself in a jail cell at risk of her suicidal ideation. But they didn't do a full review of her. They put her in a cell by herself. There was opportunities for her to be in the cell with other women so that she could have the caring company of other individuals. And so there are many things, there are many reforms of our whole criminal legal system that need to occur in order to protect the lives of the most disenfranchised. Yeah. And so it happens over and over and over again. And you know, it's important for us to understand this. And I'm glad we're having the conversation because it often gets conflated in our own issues of violence within community. And people don't really understand how grave this issue is. And we don't even have the data for it. And I know that I continue to say that, but we don't have an understanding of this. So that's why it's so important for us to have this conversation.
Yes. Now, I was just going to add, when you think about the term death in custody, I'm sure you're considering not just when the violence comes directly from the officer, as you said, putting someone in a position where they may be vulnerable to violence from another person who is also in custody, failing to come to the medical aid of someone. Just I think it was just last week that one of the other officers at the site of the George Floyd killing was also held accountable because they also have responsibilities, right? When you are in custody, we give the government, through these officers, money and authority to hold people in custody. And when you are under the custody of the government, you should be as safe as you will ever be. But if you have a medical concern, if you have concerns about other things in your environment that are threatening you to often and sometimes deliberately, or even if not deliberately, to negligently allow harm to come to someone while they are in custody, that's the type of violence that you have to begin to count. If your job is to make widgets and you make 100 widgets and 12 of them are destroyed and you're not even counting how many are destroyed, you just say, I'm a widget maker, don't count how many I've destroyed, that means that you do not, in my view, have the legitimate right to continue making widgets. If you refuse to be held accountable for how many are successfully made and how many are destroyed.
But, so good. But Dr. Mitchell, you said something a few minutes ago. You said where there is a perception that this is real, that we feel. But, you know, I would argue it's more than perception. It's more than a feeling. It is very real.
No,
we
it's real.
And it's not... I mean, let's be honest. This is not real for, just black people. We see these things happening, like the 4th of July truck stop in Ohio, in Circleville, Ohio, Jadarius Rose, where he said when he was, talking to the 911 dispatcher, he said that, I don't want them to kill me. I'm paraphrasing here. I don't want to die. Police were going to stop him for a flap over his tire. Is that legitimate? Absolutely. Because we're talking about the safety of tractor trailers on the road. So, yes. But with that said, whether it could have been any other kind of violation, he didn't know about it, but he saw the police there, and he was afraid.
I drive down the street, and if there's a cop that's anywhere near me, I'm checking my rearview mirrors.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the abuse, and I didn't do anything wrong, and I feel guilty. I did nothing wrong. Fully licensed, fully capable of driving my vehicle, not speeding. But I'm checking my rear view. I'm making sure that my seatbelt's on. I'm wondering whether or not I'm going to get stopped for whatever reason. So, no, I think in our community, it's an absolute real thing that has existed and will continue to exist. My argument is that we count what we care about in this country.
Mm-hmm.
We look at what we care about. We investigate what we care about. I ran the COVID disaster morgue for this city during COVID. I was the chief medical examiner for the city during that time period. And at that time period, the Centers for Disease Control sent out a letter to all of us that signed death certificates and said, we need to track how many people are dying from COVID in this country. We want you to sign your death certificates this way, so that we can capture it in real time and make data available to our public health officials that are trying to respond to this deadly disease. And we did that. And all of that data that everybody was reporting on every single day, that real-time death data, was coming from people like me, right? All over the country that band together and made a decision to capture that data so that we could solve a problem.
So in attempting to harvest this data and to share it with the masses, what kind of reception have you received?
That's really good. So I've reached out to the Centers for Disease Control, and I've gotten every excuse in the book about why that checkbox can't go on the death certificate. There's a administrator, his name is Dr. Paul Sutton. he has the ability to orchestrate and put the checkbox on the U.S. standard death certificate. It does not need a legislation. I actually put, along with several people in this city, there is a checkbox on the D.C. death certificate. So right now, the Department of Health, D.C.
So wait a minute, let me stop you. What's on the death certificate in D.C.?
There is a checkbox that says death in custody, yes or no, in the District of Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we, right now, we have an accurate account of how many people die in the custody of law enforcement in the D.C. jail through the activities of the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner and captured by D.C.'s Department of Health.
What is on, for example, any death certificate? And I've seen them because obviously, you know, I've lost family members.
Sure.
So, but what are the options? Natural suicide? What have you seen?
So what's on the death certificate is name, age, race, gender, occupation, cause of death.
As far as the cause of death. What are the options for checking?
So cause of death, it can be anything. But manner of death are the five manners of death,
okay,
right? Homicide, suicide, natural, accident, undetermined. But there's a lot of other boxes that give us context to that death.
Well, what's the difference between cause and manner?
So cause is the injury or disease that's responsible for the death. Gunshot wound of the head.
Is a cause. Okay.
But the manner of death may be a suicide or a homicide, depending upon the circumstance.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. I've been watching a lot of Law and Order, but apparently not enough. But well, please continue. Yeah.
But there's a lot of contextual information on a death certificate that gives public health surveillance, the federal government gives local government an idea of the circumstances surrounding death so those deaths can be prevented. The whole purpose of a death certificate is to capture someone who's born and someone who's died for the purpose of census and the purpose of finances. And then the other pieces is to make sure that we understand the context, causes, and manners of death so that we can develop structures to prevent them. Cancer is probably the biggest use of the death certificate. Cancer and the work surrounding anti-cancer movements has utilized the death certificate, monetized the data that have come out of death certificates to generate a whole infrastructure to research these deaths and try to prevent them. Mm-hmm. And that's happening all over the time. It happens with COVID. It's happening with motor vehicle collisions. It happens mm-hmm. with baby mothers that are dying. Babies that are dying, all of these things utilize the death certificate to gain an idea of the burden of disease and injury within a community. And what we're saying is that deaths in custody is such a public health concern that we should be looking at all of the deaths in custody as a separate category all over the country to understand what are the circumstances by which we're dying in and around the criminal legal system and capturing that data and then looking to hold people accountable for the care that constitutionally has been taken away from them for whatever reason and given to government. Now you're in the care of government. Government's responsible to be able to give you the care that you require.
Professor Hansford, do you believe that the step of, you know, body cameras was part of moving in that direction towards accountability? I mean, we've seen enough stories about body cameras that sometimes they're shaky. We don't get to see everything. But I go back to the Tyre Nichols situation where we saw this horror show. There was so much video. It is undeniable, really, I think, what happened to him. But there was no body camera in the Michael Brown case, none in the George Floyd case. So is that account of our police department moving, however slowly, towards addressing the accountability issue?
Well, I'll say this. I also see the increased accountability of body cameras. Now, of course, when you're looking at these reforms, the analysis is how does this converge with the interests of law enforcement. With body cameras, the pitch was law enforcement can use that to defend themselves if they're wrongly accused of some sort of violence. Of course, we know that they can turn those off and on if they need to. The makers of those body cameras are the taser company, so there's economic interest at stake. So there, when we were involved in this advocacy over the last 9 years or 10 years, we've had a menu of reforms. We can list them off. You know, community control of police. You know, the one thing after the other, changing use of force standards. Body cameras caught on because those were the reforms that also had a convergence of interest. That's something we learned from Derrick Bell in the critical race theory literature. When interests converge, then your reform is likely to find champions on both sides and make a change. So the question here, how could a changing in accountability in terms of counting deaths in custody be a place where we can find interest convergence? I'm not sure what that is, but it is clearly the case that if you were to count the deaths in custody, no matter what, I think you'd see a change right away in police activities in terms of just being more knowledgeable about the fact that this will see the light of day. So I do think that this is a positive reform. It's the type of reform that won't cost anything necessarily. You're talking about a checkbox on a medical examiner's paperwork. You're not talking about a multi-million dollar outlay of finances. So this is the type of reform that ought to be a no-brainer.
Indeed. There's so much that we could continue to discuss here. We could really talk about this for another hour or so, I'm quite sure. But I do want to congratulate you, Dr. Mitchell, on the book and the work that you are doing and trying to get done. So I appreciate your time. Also, Professor Hansford, thank you so much for coming in. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Well, finally tonight, it is an unpleasant reality for so many in the Black community. The flashing red and blue lights in the rearview mirror can cause heightened anxiety during a police traffic stop. What did you do? Where did you put your hands? Do you turn on the phone? Do you call home? Are you going to make it home? Why are we at this point when interacting with those sworn to protect and serve? They're nervous, you're nervous, you gave your kids the talk. You should remember it too. You've got to figure out a better way to make sure after these encounters that everyone gets home alive. That is the Daily Drum for this Wednesday, August 9th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.